this company broke the law, they violated the rights of these workers, and these workers need to be commended for standing up for their rights.
Hotel union members in Anchorage celebrate a court victory. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaskans study the resource industry in Norway.
They work very closely with industry, with communities, and with the government to make sure that they're doing it right.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Local hotel employee union members are celebrating what they say is a major win against the Sheraton Anchorage Hotel. A federal judge has sided with Unite Here, Local 878, in many of its complaints against the hotel. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Anna Rodriguez worked as a housekeeping supervisor at the Sheraton Anchorage. She says she was fired from her job there last December because of her union activities. But Thursday, Anna says housekeepers at the Sheraton will benefit from a court decision which will give them back their 30-minute breaks and reduce the number of rooms that they must clean each day from 17 to 15.
Well, it's very hard to do the 17 rooms for the ladies. Some of them are cutting their break in order to finish their 17 rooms. Some of them getting hurt because of the stress and the hurry to finish the 17 rooms. Otherwise, they get in trouble if they don't finish the 17 rooms.
She says Sheraton management upped the number of rooms a maid must clean in a workday, and that's just one of the complaints the union filed against the hotel with the National Labor Relations Board. Thursday, Unite Here officials announced a victory in the ongoing dispute with the Sheraton. Vince Beltrami, president of Alaska's AFL-CIO, says the decision by Washington, D.C.-based administrative law judge Gregory Z. Meyerson has vindicated workers' rights.
This company broke the law. They violated the rights of these workers. And these workers need to be commended for standing up for their rights, for doing what they know is right to ensure just nothing but decent treatment in the workplace. These workers haven't asked for huge raises and outlandish, you know, requests from management. They basically said, let us keep doing our jobs, don't try to add more to what we do, pay us reasonably, and give us the and let us retain the health care that we've had for contracts for years.
The union brought 16 complaints of labor violations against the Sheraton to court, among them objections to the replacement of the union-sponsored medical plan with a company-selected plan, and the hotel's refusal to accept the union as the lawful representative of the hotel's hourly wage workers. Marvin Jones, president of Unite Here Local 878, says the dispute with the Sheraton began when the hotel management was taken over by a Texas company, Remington Lodging and Hospitality. Jones says the hotel workers involved in the dispute are longtime employees that make their home in Anchorage.
The company thought that being in Alaska would be an easy target. I think that backfired. The workers have been much stronger than they anticipated.
Judge Meyerson's decision validated about half of the allegations the union brought against the hotel. Carl Terrell, an attorney for Remington, said in an email the NLRB is biased and that he is not surprised by Judge Meyerson's decision. Terrell says Remington is pleased that the judge sided with the Sheraton on several important issues, quote, including his determination that the hotel negotiated in good faith. The judge's decision is only a recommendation to the board in Washington as to how it should rule. We will be filing exceptions to the parts of the judge's adverse recommendation that we disagree with, unquote. Terrell says many hotel employees voted to stay out of the union and that the Sheraton is fighting to protect their rights. Despite Judge Meyerson's August 25th decision, the dispute is far from over. Union President Marvin Jones says a boycott against the Sheraton will continue.
Well, the next step is we have to We have to continue with the attitude that we will fight one day longer. I mean, that's really the attitude that we have to have. It's been the thing that has kept these members' spirits up. And that if we have the attitude, then people are not disappointed or frustrated with how long this is going to take, because we understand that management's intention is to break the will of the people, is to break this local financially.
Jones says an employee contract with the Sheraton is still on the table. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A utility workers' strike in Anchorage has been averted due to health concerns. Anchorage Water and Wastewater utility workers voted overwhelmingly on Wednesday to go on strike. The move comes after a dispute between the municipality and the Plumbers and Pipefitters Union Local 367 over pay issues. The city and the union have failed to reach agreement on a wage increase for a new contract. Today, the city received a court injunction enjoining the water utility workers from striking over the unresolved contract issues. Alaska Superior Court Judge Frank Feifner says plumbers and pipefitters union employees who work for the city are covered by the Anchorage Municipal Code, and the city workers in the code's A2 category may not go on strike for an unlimited length of time because of health issues. Attorney Charles Dunnigan represents the plumbers union. He says the union is cooperating with the ruling.
We've been on board with this from the beginning. I sent them a letter this morning basically giving them the preliminary injunction, agreeing that a strike would have the potential to cause irreparable harm to the public, and gave them in writing statements that triggered their ability to get an injunction. We did not oppose them on any point.
Dunnigan says the strike may be permanently enjoined because of the importance of the water employees' work. The union had announced its intention to strike starting tomorrow. Dunnigan says if the union gives up its right to strike, the water workers may gain some of their contract goals. Under the judge's ruling today, the contract dispute will now go to the courts. A hearing is set for November 10th. The oil and gas industry is about to start exploratory drilling in the deeper waters of Cook Inlet, perhaps by tomorrow. One jackup drilling rig is in place, and a second was just bought, and the owner hopes to have it drilling here by next spring. APRN's Steve Heimel has an update.
Late this morning, the jackup drilling rig owned by Escapeta Oil was poised to begin drilling, awaiting a nod from State Oil and Gas Division Director Bill Barron, who was waiting for an inspection report from the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission due later in the day. Barron said he's glad to have Escapeta in the inlet, and all the problems he complained about in a letter earlier this month appear to be resolved. It was a difficult arrival for the company, and Texas owner Danny Davis did not survive it, but stepped down in an apparent effort to get resolution of Jones Act issues involving the use of a Chinese vessel to move the rig from the Gulf of Mexico around South America. The Jones Act forbids the use of non-U.S. boats to deliver between U.S. ports, and Davis contended there was no U.S. vessel that could safely do it and tried to use a waiver that was intended for a different vessel. The Customs and Border Protection Office is not saying what its enforcement action will be, but has said it will not seize the rig. If Escapeta drills, it qualifies for a state tax credit of $25 million for the first well and also credits for the next two wells. Its rig is called the Spartan 151. Another company, Buccaneer Energy, is also operating with state financial help. It has $30 million from the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority to help it buy a rig it today announced it had acquired from Transocean for $68.5 million. That rig is in Malaysia. It's called the Adriatic 11. Buccaneer plans to have it fitted out and across the Pacific by April or May. Buccaneer's rig can drill in waters a little deeper than Escapeta's. Both companies are looking for crude oil, but would be happy to sell natural gas as well. The Cook Inlet market is not big enough to make an offshore gas field pay off. Buccaneer is already producing onshore gas in the city of Kenai and drilling a second well there. A contract to sell that gas to NSTAR is pending approval at the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, one man's solution to housing the homeless on cold nights.
Open up the city halls. Open up the city building first floors. Put a match down. Other cities do it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. We all need energy to power our homes and businesses. Tapping renewable energy sources like wind, geothermal, and hydro helps keep our economy local, creating jobs, revenue, and power for the state. Learn more at realaska.org. This message sponsored by Renewable Energy Alaska Project, committed to creating a sustainable economic future for Alaska.
About a dozen Alaska lawmakers and others are in Norway looking at how the country develops its renewable and fossil fuel resources. Norway gets 98% of its energy for in-country use from hydropower. They export their oil and gas to Europe and other markets, mainly through a system of seabed pipelines. Nils Andreasen is the managing director at Anchorage-based Institute of the North, the organization that pulled the visit to Norway together. He says oil development is run by a coalition of state and private industry, and all their oil production is offshore. He says he's hearing positive comments from Alaska's legislators.
I think everybody's just very impressed with the competence that the Norwegian government has displayed in its development. I think the capacity and the resources applied to really getting it right, to making sure that investment isn't curtailed based on the tax regime, at the same time that the Norwegian government is very committed to getting its maximum benefit from its resources. I think we'll be spending actually a few hours tomorrow as a group kind of brainstorming what are the action items, what are the recommendations that we do feel should be brought back to Alaska.
And what about their environmental record? All of their development, their oil infrastructure is offshore.
I think they've got some of the most stringent environmental regulations in the world. They haven't had any major incidences in their history, in their 30, 40-year history. They have a regulatory body that's committed specifically to health and environmental issues, and they work very closely with industry, with communities, and with the government to make sure that they're doing it right.
And what have you been able to determine, if you have, about the relationship between the government body of Norway and the oil producers? Is it contentious? You mentioned that they're very strictly regulated. What have you been able to find out about that?
Yeah, it's interesting because they've noted that in the U.S. and maybe in Alaska that it is an us versus them or a contentious relationship. And in Norway, it's not like that. It's a partnership. It's a relationship in which both parties profit, both parties understand one another, work well with one another. I think they spend a lot of time up front making sure they've got the right relationships in place to make sure this works.
And how does it compare to Alaska, the amount that the government of Norway gets from the oil production? How does that compare to what Alaska takes here?
It's actually fairly similar, I think. It's very complicated at the same time, and a different structure. I think royalties in Alaska versus a different tax structure in Norway, but roughly the same. Both countries, Alaska and Norway, have various kinds of investments or deductions that companies can apply.
We hear in Alaska a lot of argument from pro-development folks that there's too much regulation, that the environmental standards are too stiff here in the U.S. and in Alaska. After seeing the structure is in Norway, does that make sense?
I think the Norwegians, rather than multiple bodies trying to oversee multiple regulations, they have a one-stop shop where in a very simplified process where it all works out, and oil companies can trust that they're going to have a very quick process. I think it takes a very little time for an application to be vetted very completely and approved.
Nils Andreasen is the managing director of Institute of the North. Links to more details about the trip are at our website, alaskapublic.org. A town hall-style meeting took place at Anchorage's Bean Cafe on Tuesday to highlight the dangers of living outside through the upcoming winter. Bean serves daily meals to those who are homeless and the working poor. Yesterday's meeting featured speakers from the Anchorage Police Department, Catholic Social Services, and clients of Bean's and the Brother Francis Shelter located across the parking lot. A paper listing the warning signs of hypothermia was handed out. Susan Bomaleski is the Executive Director of Catholic Social Services. The organization runs Brother Francis Shelter. She says they want to get the word out that when temperatures drop below freezing, people need to come in from camps to shelter. She says there's been a 20% increase in people needing services this summer, and although they used to average about 133 people per day, they were close to 240 this summer and nearly had to house people in Bean's Cafe.
We didn't have to go over that and use Bean's over the summer, but we came very close. We also run a food pantry, St. Francis House Food Pantry, and we're seeing 20% increases in numbers in a food pantry. And usually a food pantry is kind of the first line of economic struggle. People will come and get food so they have more money to pay rent. So we're hoping that those numbers don't translate into increased need for shelter, but you know, we just don't know. So we're actually bringing on extra staff. The municipality is giving us a grant to help pay for some of that extra staff so that we're ready.
The numbers are bleak and growing more disturbing for poor people struggling to keep a home and food on the table. Daryl Hess with the Municipality of Anchorage said in less than 20 years, medical expenses have risen 424%, housing 174%, and all other expenses have jumped nearly 200%, while local wages have risen by 88%. Bean's Cafe Executive Director Jim Crockett says a man from Detroit recently showed up in an aging Winnebago with 9 children.
He said, "Oh, I've come up for the permanent fund. Wonderful opportunity. I understand it was $1,200 last year. Got myself and 9 kids. That's $12,000. You know, had no food, nothing. So yeah, we're seeing a huge influx of people coming in."
He says he gave the man a week's worth of food, but when he was told he wouldn't qualify for the PFD for well over a year, he didn't have any idea of what he and the 9 kids would do. He didn't have money to leave the state. Crockett has been involved with Bean's for nearly 2 decades. He says it's not just homeless people that come for meals, it's also the working poor.
People that have apartments, people that look in their refrigerators in the 9th or 10th of the month and there's nothing there. So they come down here. So I have seen more cars with more duct tape than I've ever seen before.
Crockett says he worries about the growing divide between those who can make it and those who fall into poverty.
And the difference between the people that are rich and people that are poor is just widening like crazy. You just see it. And it's frightening. You know, you don't see a middle class anymore. It's gone.
He says the town hall meetings have been good opportunities for people in need to help come up with solutions to the problems they face. One of the clients that spoke during the gathering was Nickel Nellinger. He's been on the streets on and off since arriving from Baltimore more than 20 years ago. He says the available beds for cold nights number in the hundreds, but the people who need them are in the thousands. He says he's tired of people freezing to death, so he offered a solution.
Open up the city halls. Open up the city building first floors. Put mats down. Other cities do it. And as far as cost, believe me, hiring 2 people to sit there at night and watch security or whatever is a heck of a lot cheaper than what the police department's doing, going around pulling people out of camps, taking bodies, the whole 9 yards.
He says when he first came to Anchorage, the average age of the homeless was somewhere in the 40s. Now he sees more people in their 20s. He says he's homeless by choice, but most people aren't. They're stuck, and they can't just go away.
Heck, I ain't got 20 cents. How am I going to get a dollar coffee? How are they going to leave?
There is at least partial relief on the horizon with an expansion of Clare House that will add 73 beds for homeless women and children, and a 2012 draft plan for the municipality that seeks proposals for housing specific to those with mental health issues or those who have been released from incarceration. Rockfish swim in deep waters off Alaska, and when they're caught and brought to the surface, the pressure changes can cause incredible trauma. But a recently completed study from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game shows the fish have an amazing ability to recover if they're released back down at depth. Sam Hulkhalter is an ADF&G fishery biologist who worked on the study. He says 98% of the fish in the study survived when they were released at depth.
It's hard to imagine your stomach hanging out of your mouth and then being sent back down to the pressure that you're captured at and to have all of that reversed. Your eyes go back in. I mean, we know the optic nerve is stretched. All the musculature around the eyes is stretched. And their swim bladders can fully rupture. And it's just really astonishing to think that the vast majority of these fish are able to fully recover.
Only 22% of the rockfish survived when they were released at the surface. Hulkhalter says one of every two rockfish caught by sports anglers statewide are released, and he hopes this new information will help convince anglers to return those fish to the depth of capture.
It has the potential to dramatically reduce the number of rockfish that are removed from the fishery. I use the word removed because if a fish is released back into the water and it subsequently dies, it's not technically harvested, but it is removed from the population.
More and more rockfish are caught and harvested in recreational fisheries in Alaska each year. But Hulkhalter says not much is known about the state's rockfish populations. But biologists do know the fish live a very long time, up to 150 years. That makes them susceptible to overharvest. Hulkhalter says they're also late to reach sexual maturity.
So for yellow eye, I think the age of first sexual maturity can be anywhere from 15 to 25 years old. So that has important implications for when they're harvested, because many of these fish are caught and can be harvested before they even have the opportunity to reproduce one time.
Hulkhalter says there are commercial tools available to release fish at depth. He says homemade versions work too.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Petersburg's plan to form a borough is drawing opposition from several surrounding communities. While Juneau, Cake, and Kuprianov say they don't oppose a Petersburg borough, they are concerned about its boundaries. Petersburg is on Mitkoff Island, where the Wrangell Narrows meet Frederick Sound. Its proposed borough would be about 4,374 square miles, both land and water. The new Petersburg boundaries would stretch into an area previously identified for annexation to the city and borough of Juneau. All the territory from the southern boundary of the CBJ and east to the Canadian border. It includes the Tracy Arm, Ford's Terror Wilderness, Endicott Arm, as well as Holcomb, Windham, and Hobart Bays. 30,000 acres at Hobart Bay are owned by Gold Belt, Juneau's native corporation. Mayor Bruce Botello says Juneau has never filed to annex the area in deference to Gold Belt, which previously opposed putting its Hobart Bay land in a borough. In 2007, Juneau made the decision to
withhold trying to move in that direction unless there was some triggering action. One of those that was contemplated was the possibility that another community would start the process of annexation or incorporation of those lands.
Gold Belt Corporation says it's currently neutral with regard to which borough, if any, should encompass Hobart Bay. In a letter to both Botello and Petersburg Mayor Al Dwyer, Gold Belt Operations Vice President Derek Duncan says the board will decide its borough preference over the next couple of months. Dwyer says Petersburg's new boundary line would be about the center of Hobart Bay and adjacent to Juneau's boundary.
They're traditionally used by fishermen and others from Petersburg, and we've justified the boundaries because of past use. We expect there'll be development in those areas that we've delineated.
Over the next few weeks, Juneau will have to answer whether Petersburg's petition to include those areas in a borough is the trigger for Juneau annexation. Juneau Assemblymember Peter Freer believes it is. Over the last decade, several southeast communities have expanded their boundaries. Ketchikan through annexation, Wrangell and Skagway have incorporated, and a number of other communities are examining new boundaries.
It is in our interests, I think, to act and define that area that we believe would ultimately or should ultimately be a part of our borough.
Meanwhile, both the City of Cake and the Organized Village of Cake plan to protest the Petersburg borough. The small first-class city of about 560 is on the northwest coast of Kuprianov Island. The new borough would encompass a large part of the island, which Cake says are ancestral lands. John Janik is Cake City Administrator.
They're taking up what appears to be a little over half of the island, if not more. And the land they're trying to encompass actually is historically some native cultural land.
On the northeast shore of Kuprianov Island, the tiny second-class city of Kuprianov, population about 30, is also opposed. But Wrangell, which became a borough in 2008, says it doesn't have any major issues with the proposed Petersburg borough boundaries. The Juneau Assembly will take up the issue again later this month. Federal and state transportation officials held an open house today at Denali National Park to talk about a project to replace a bridge on the park's highway and to get public comments about the proposal. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Work on a new bridge across Riley Creek won't begin until 2014 at the earliest, but State Transportation and Public Facilities Department spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says her agency wants to show the public what they've got in mind and hear their feedback. She says the $15 million project would include more than just a new bridge.
The scope includes construction of parking lots and bicycle and pedestrian facilities to cross the bridge.
Bailey says that because the project would be located near the entrance to Denali National Park at milepost 237 on the park's highway, it will involve the Federal Highway Administration and the National Park Service, and the cost will be split between the state and the feds. She says the agencies also will coordinate the project with tourism-related businesses in the area because it's a busy place.
We'd have to work closely with tour companies and with the Park Service, since this is obviously an area with very high volume visitors.
In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. APRN's Annie Fite and Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
The Rasmussen Foundation Sabbatical Program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth. As a result, organizations often become stronger. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.